Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. We're starting the show today by talking about adding native plants to your garden, no matter what size your garden is. And we've got Melinda Myers back with us. Melinda, of course, a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, over 20 books, 35 years of horticulture experience. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What's stopping you from adding natives to your garden space? Do you have questions about designing with natives? What other gardening questions do you have? We'll certainly take the broad range of questions here as we visit with her. And you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always great to chat with you and your listeners, Larry.
Lots of reasons to add native plants, I think, to the garden. Tell us, in your mind, why is it good?
You know, it brings in the pollinators, supports our pollinators and songbirds as well that have evolved with those. And I don't know about you, but that added motion and color that the butterflies, the hummingbirds, and the songbirds add to my garden, especially in winter, is always welcome. So it's helping that. I do a lot of work on trying to help water stay where it falls to really reduce stormwater problems. And native plants do a great job of helping manage stormwater. Their deep roots create pathways. So as the water runs off your roof and the driveway and the walk, those plants slow down the velocity. They've created those openings for the water to go down. And then the roots of plants and our soil help remove many of the impurities. And so it's great because by the time it gets to the groundwater, it's a lot cleaner than what's running off our driveway and walks. And a lot of times native plants are the solution. And just like any plant we add, though, we want to make sure we use the right plant for the growing conditions and the available space, because some of those native plants can be a little more aggressive than we have room for.
Well, in terms of space, you know, I think there is a misconception that you need a lot of space to have a native garden, but
exactly,
you don't necessarily need a lot of space.
You bet. And that's kind of where, you know, we all love Neil DeBole. He's, you know, I've learned so much from him. So, Neil, if you're listening, I'm not trying to impose on your area, but trying to help people with maybe city lots or suburban lots that maybe aren't looking to create a prairie yet, but include some of those native plants. And so I always like to say, start small, especially if you share your yard or you're in a neighborhood where not everybody appreciates native plants and maybe have that misconception that they're weeds, right? So start by substituting. Look for opportunities. So something dies over winter, can you put a native plant in its place? And I think prairie drop seed, one of my favorites, is a great example. So fountain grass, if you've driven through parks and boulevards, especially in Milwaukee, you've seen tons of fountain grass in the past. And prairie drop seed has a similar growth habit. But the benefits are it's a host plant. It also has flowers late in the season that they smell like, I've heard it described as coriander, I think burnt popcorn, but but you know it's blooming, and then some subtle fall color, and then when the ice forms on the seed heads, they look like gems, so you get year-round beauty, and you're putting that native plant that fits well not only in natural plantings, but also informal and even formal gardens as well. So I think that's a great place to start, and as you look at those plants, look for those that are clumpers that either slowly spread, but don't reseed readily and don't take over the garden. Get familiar with what works in your landscape and your landscape design, and then maybe you go to a whole garden of native plants.
Yeah, I like how you think.
Well, Evelyn Howe of UW-Madison, I once heard her speak, and she said, we try to take these plants native to a, you know, 1,000-acre habitat and put them on a quarter-acre lot and expect them to act the same. And so I always took that with me that, you know, how can we, as small-space gardeners in the city or suburbs, really be part of the solution while maintaining a landscape that we can maintain? You know, I love I love cup plant, but in the city, that'd be your whole landscape, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you want to pick so that you can manage. You know, bee balm is great, wild bergamot. But I've also seen rain gardens that people couldn't keep up dividing and, you know, thinning out seedlings. I get it. We're all busy. And they become nothing but wild bergamot. And so, you know, it doesn't mean you can't add those, but you got to be willing to manage them or look for those that you can manage easily.
And what about, I'm thinking now about folks who live in apartments or don't have a space. Will natives, you know, fit in pots?
You bet. I think it's a trend. I saw, I did an activity. So if you go to my website, I potted up a couple, and I love including them in a container. Some do better. So I think it's Missouri Botanic Garden had a few examples, and I provide some plants that will give you some beauty. So I did a spring one, so included some golden Alexander, some wild geranium, also a few other spring bloomers. So when they're done blooming, I have a choice. I can just kind of put it in a sunny spot and combine it with my other flowering containers. I luckily have some in-ground space, so I can pop them in the garden eventually. And, you know, if you're an apartment dweller and you don't want to overwinter them in an unheated, if you don't have access to a good place to overwinter them, there's someone in your life that will either help you or take them off your hand, and then you can buy something new, right, and change things out a bit.
Natives, as you said, they can be aggressive. Nativars comes into the conversation pretty often these days. And maybe it's worth it to, and we've talked about this, I think, in the past on the show, but I think it's worth repeating. Explain nativars, what they are, and why some people don't think they're real natives.
And, right.
And the other part of it is, how do you pick them out if you go to the garden center?
Yeah,
that they're not natives.
And I really appreciate that you're bringing that up, because I do think there's room for both sides. And I always like to present both views, and then you as the gardener get to decide. And a lot of breeders are calling them natives because they have native plant genetics, but they have been hybridized, either to have maybe a different color flower or maybe be more contained. And switchgrass is a great example. So switchgrass, if you grow the species, you will have a lot of it. But the cultivars, like Northwind Perennial or Heavy Metal or some of the new Prairie Winds, are more clumping. And they still have some of the qualities of the native plants, but not totally. So people that are anti-cultivars of native plants, nativars, say they're not as good for pollinators and the songbirds, and those others who are saying, but this may be the only choice for some people given the space. So I always like to present both sides. You get to decide what works for you. But usually you can tell if they say native, then in single quotes it will have the name of that cultivar. So you know it's been hybridized. So it would be Panicum Virginum. That tells you it's a switchgrass. And single quotes, Heavy Metal. And so you know that that's been hybridized for a more upright clumping growth habit with bluish green leaves. And so it gives you a little more insight so that you can make a decision that works well for you.
The thought is that the insects, butterflies and so forth, don't get anything out of the nativars.
Right. And there seems to be some research happening that shows that maybe our I just found a research that even mixing cultivated plants with native plants seems to have some benefits as climate change is happening and expanding pollen. So I think we're in a very interesting time learning more, and agree that, you know, there's still a lot of research that has to go on. But obviously native plants have evolved with native species, insects, songbirds, that type of thing, that is a good bet if you can do that. And Neil, I'm going to give Neil a shout out because I use his website all the time and his book. He talks about the pollinators the native plants support. He talks about concerns, will they tolerate black walnut? will deer, do they tend to be resistant to deer? And in his description, he also talks about this is a good one for a garden, or this one can be aggressive and reseed readily. And, you know, do your research if you're new to native plants. I'm always learning something new. And in his website, and there are others as well, but his website and his book, that we all waited for. I know you did too, Larry.
It sure did. But I have my copy.
Mine's sitting right by me now in case I need to reference something quickly here.
Oh, man. You know, just one other thing before we get to Neil and Rockford. This whole question about what is a native plant always kind of interested me because how do you define what is a native plant? Because it can be pretty arbitrary, I think, in some cases.
You bet. So, you know, I'm always, you know, I'm lucky I get to meet lots of gardeners, and they help me keep learning more. And probably the one definition I heard that seemed to be true, Lady Bird Johnson's Wildflower Center uses native plants are those that have been reported occurring naturally within a certain area. And over time, they've evolved and adapted to those conditions along with all the other native species, the insects and the songbirds. And so sometimes when people look at native plants, myself included, they may not be native to Wisconsin, like pale purple coneflower is native, but purple coneflower, I saw a tag that said, is a near native. I mean, it's across the border. I've never seen that until this spring. It's a near native. And so you may want to broaden it.
I don't worry too much about it.
I don't either, because I feel like if it's going to work in the growing conditions and the climate, one of my favorite is false blue indigo. Not native here, a near native, and it goes great in my garden, and it provides a lot of benefits. And I think, you know, it's your garden, so you make those decisions. But I think thinking broadly, definitely, I kind of try to, you know, native to the area, to the growing conditions, right? Makes it a lot less stressful, too.
And now let's take that call from Neil, who's in Rockford, Illinois. Neil.
Hey, Linda. Hey, Larry.
Hi. Neil DeBall.
Hey, Neil. Okay, you can correct me on anything I said wrong.
No. Melinda, you know everything. You know so much more than I could ever hope to know.
That's not true, but thank you.
So I'm in Rockford on my way to visit my mother. She's 96 years old. So this is the only time I get to listen to Garden Talk because I'm always at work.
I know. That's why I thought I was safe, Neil. Oh, he'll be
anyway,
busy. He won't hear me.
I always want to hear you. This is wonderful. But I just wanted to reinforce what you said about native plants in the garden, is that there are plants, like prairie plants in particular, who are really well suited to gardens because they are more tame, if we will, and don't creep by rhizomes and don't seed all over the place like big blue stem and cup plant. And so there are a number of prairie plants that should never be put in a garden because they're just too aggressive. So
exactly. And I think, thank you for reinforcing that, because you're right. We want to do the right thing, and then we're like, we have a mess, and then we're like, give it up. And we need to help people be successful, which is what you do.
And another thing is, if I might, is that you have a situation where there are different plants that have different longevities. Like, for instance, black-eyed Susan is a biennial. So it's not a really good garden plant. It's gone in a couple of years, unless, of course, it likes to seed everywhere, which helps. But one of the things that was really important in our book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, was to list the lifespans of these plants, because some plants will live for decades. So if you want your garden to resemble what you designed in the first place, you won't have these plants that only live a few years dying out and having to be replaced. So you can put in plants that live 10 to 20 years or 20 plus years and get the results that you want.
Very good point. Very good point.
And size. I have to tell you, Neil, so I love false blue indigo, Baptisia, and I have read the tags, and I have put it in places I'm rearranging some other plants around it, and I am trimming it back after it blooms. I love the seed pods, but it blocks a window. So, you know, it's like I tell everybody read the tag and believe it, and I didn't, so shame on me. So also size, you know, Baptisia is a huge plant. Give it room so you can enjoy it, and you don't have to move it.
And here's something else about Baptisia that's really fascinating, is that white false indigo, Baptisia alba, has a thin stem at the base with all of the foliage higher up. And blue false indigo, Baptisia australis, is like a shrub, and it has foliage at the base. So it's almost a completely no-maintenance plant because it smothers out weeds at the base. But the white false indigo, you have to plant lower-growing plants, shorter grasses, et cetera, underneath it in order to keep the weeds at bay. So it's really interesting. Every species, even though it's in the same genus, has different behavior. So you have to know how that plant behaves when it's in the garden.
And I do think that's a benefit. One reason, especially for urban, suburban people, or if you're new to the whole, is getting familiar with the plants, right? Because it's a big learning curve if you haven't done it before. Not that it's bad, but...
Yeah.
Well, listen, Neil, say hi to that 96-year-old mom of yours. You got Mother's Day weekend here. Say hi to her from Melinda and I, and safe travels. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling in. Always great to chat with you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Neil DeBole joining us on his way to visit his mother on Mother's Day, and she's 96 years old.
Wow.
Which gives you an idea how old Neil is.
Now that he's hung up, you can say that. Don't let him through, Jill, if he redials quickly.
Oh, gosh. And Melinda Myers, our guest today. Great to have her with us. And you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email, and we already have some emails. We'll get to those in just a minute or so. You can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Big thanks to everybody who donated during our spring member drive. I think we had over 1,700 donations during that time, and your contributions, of course, help keep WPR strong. We have some, I think Kelly and McFarland, Heidi and Jeff in Madison are folks who have contributed. And if you missed the drive, there's still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. But a big thanks to everybody who has contributed. And while I'm at it, I do want to mention that Jill Nadeau and I will be at the Widener Center in Green Bay to give a talk about my years here at WPR. And 7 o'clock on this coming Tuesday night. I guess we were in one room, but it wasn't big enough, so they're putting us in another room in the Widener Center, so they now have room for more tickets. So if you would like to come in, it's a free event, but these have been just a blast, really a lot of fun for both Jill and I, and I think for everybody who comes. You can go to WPR.org/presents. And there's a whole bunch of dates of a whole bunch of different things that we're doing here at WPR. But scroll down, you'll find the event for Green Bay at the Widener Center. And that's this coming Tuesday. And if you're in the Madison area, scroll down a little further and you'll find the June 3rd, where we'll be at the Barrymore Theater in Madison. I think 7 o'clock that same evening, and you could sign up for a ticket at the same place. Love to have you here. Well, back to plants. Vivian in Reedsburg emailed, last year her zinnia seeds barely grew, maybe 10% of the total seeds germinated, and that was a first for her. She's been reading about required soil temperature, and it seems zinnias are one of the varieties that require the warmest temps. Could you explain how to measure soil temperature? It's important to compare to air temperature and soil type as it is related to temperature. Her soil is pretty heavy clay with composted leaves and bagged manure added annually. Plus, do you think this could have been the culprit as to why the seeds failed? cooler soil temperatures. So what do you do to measure soil? I've got my own system, which is
tried and true. And what is that, Larry?
There's two systems. My old friend Mark Larson said he likes to drop his pants.
Okay.
And sort of wiggle into the soil a little bit. And depending on, he has his timed out, depending on if he has to stand up quickly, he knows that the soil's too cold. Let's put it that way. I prefer not to drop my pants in my neighborhood. So I use a ThermoWorks. It's a thermometer, and it is amazing because you can do your meats, you can do, if you're making candy or something and you need that, you can use that for precise temperatures. I can hold it up outside and it'll tell me what the temperature is outside, and I can stick it in the ground.
Last night I was giving a talk and we were talking soil temperatures, and I said I was listening to Larry Mueller and Patty Nagai, and they all use their meat thermometer in the soil.
Well, it's a little pricier meat thermometer. It's like about $80.
Oh, okay.
But it'll measure, and it's precise.
That's good.
It's precise. That's what I really like about ThermoWorks temperature thermometer. And I just have to remember to clean it off after I've stuck it in the ground.
We decided that's a way to keep people from inviting themselves to dinner at your house. But if you don't want to go to that level, I have a couple of just strictly soil thermometers that are $15, I think I spent. So they're probably not as accurate, but close. I know there are some people that go barefoot. I haven't heard about going naked and laying in the soil, but I always think about zinnias when I think about putting my tomatoes in, right? You want to wait till the soil's good and warm. The other thing you can do, and I've had great success with this, is I use floating row covers. And these are fabrics that let air, light, and water through but trap the heat. And it does a couple of things. I have a landscape that I want the songbirds to come in and visit, but they sometimes like my seeds as I plant them. So one is that I'm helping speed up germination for whatever I plant, but I'm also protecting them from the birds, the songbirds. And then even with some of the wildlife, they love sunflower seeds. I hear about deer munching on sunflowers, even the seedlings. So give them some time to get up and grow. And that's another way to create a barrier. Plus, the row covers help with insect problems, too. So what I would suggest is, I like to start my zinnias indoors just to give them a jump start. But if you plant them outside, make sure the soil's warm. You might even want to prep it. Cover it with row cover to warm it up and then plant your seeds. Or if you're waiting till the end, middle to the end of May, planting them and then cover it with row cover. And that'll keep it nice and warm and speed germination.
And Vivian, you can stick your meat thermometer in the soil. And if it's, 50 degrees, is that?
I'd even go to 55, especially with heavy clay. Think about all the rain that we had last spring, especially in clay soil, even if you amend it, stays wet even longer.
Yeah.
And, so that can be an issue, too.
Okay.
Exactly. Her family's going to thank you, Larry.
Sam in Marshfield, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Sam.
Hi there. I have had an effort to do native plants that differs a little bit from what you're discussing. We have some acreage, which includes 7 acres of woods. And so I go out to the woods and look for something pretty and dig it up and move it close to the house. And I've had one success, which was a grass that is beautiful on either side of this path that I have that comes into my patio. I just pull off the seeds after it goes, it would be seeding, very well But I just pull those little, the flowers as after they become kind of, drying, right. Sort of towards drying green. And it works really well. And whether that's a good idea or not, I'd welcome your opinion. But the second thing is I happened upon directnatives.com, was thrilled that they had some natives that I've been looking for, colors I've been looking for. One was false indigo. So now you're saying it's not native.
It's near native. Yeah. I think that's
it's a near native.
Okay. Near native. Okay. And then another one is, but I was like, oh, shoot. New England aster. It's a color that I love, and it's deer resistant. But they called it native for here, but I'm not sure. And then there was a bee balm that was a beautiful color of burgundy on the outer petals and then kind of a creamy yellow on the inside. And I don't know if that's native either. I've only seen red in other areas.
Yeah.
A couple things. Thank you. You bring up some really good points. When you find things that are other than the normal color, like the bicolors, think about purple coneflower. There's been so much breeding going on to have red purple coneflowers and yellow purple coneflowers and double purple coneflowers. And those are cultivars of our native purple coneflower. And so that's where you may not see quite the same appeal. So I'm thinking that bee balm, from your description, is a cultivar of one of the native bee balms, because there is the red bee balm and the purple wild bergamot. And so it sounds like that. And so that can be an issue. New England asters, there's a lot of cultivars of those. So I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying I think we just want to make sure that you're getting what you think you're getting, right? So it sounds like from the description that those are more of a cultivated native plant. And again, many people don't have a problem with it. Some people do. So kind of something to keep in mind. I like your idea of collecting seeds. Moving woodland wildflowers, first of all, don't ever do that on anybody else's property.
No.
Right. Don't do that. And then it's kind of hard because you have to replicate that soil. Woodland native wildflowers, I think, can be a little tricky. I've had some success in my city garden and now where I'm gardening now in more sandy soils. But I buy my plants in and trying to take care of the invasive things to get the things in the woods to kind of be able to come and reemerge. But so I think doing the seeds is a great idea because you're leaving the plant intact as long as it's one that you like and it's good and it's not overly aggressive, and you're leaving it intact in the woods and then adding it nearer your house. I'm glad you brought those up. Those are some good things to think about as you're ordering plants or purchasing. Garden centers, too, I don't know. I'm finding more and more garden centers making native plants available in the garden center, so it's easier to do. You'll find the biggest variety still mail order. But I'm excited to see more and more sources for people who are shopping, because I think getting plants in front of us as we're filling our carts is a good reminder as well.
Yeah. Sam, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. And by the way, you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. With your question or comment, love to hear from you. Marianne emailed, she lives on the shore of Lake Winnebago, right on the shore. All of her neighbors use a lawn care company to get rid of everything but grass. And that's not her style. She's nerdy for nature and very wary of herbicides and their effects in runoff. And for the first time in years, she's had a burst of prickly milk thistle in her garden, and she likes to walk barefoot. So she's in a pickle. Is there a way to get rid of it, or does she call a lawn care company?
A couple things. The most eco-friendly way to manage any weed is digging. And there's a reason herbicides became so popular, because it made it easy for us. And if this is in your lawn, keeping your lawn healthy, there's some research, and I've been having trouble finding it again, that just proper fertilization, even one fertilization, can greatly reduce the amount of weeds that you have. And so kind of building the density of your turf, if that's where this weed is happening. The organic vegetation killers that are labeled kill grass and weeds burn the top off but don't kill the roots. And so that can be challenging. It's repeated, but it may be easier than digging if you keep after it. Chelated iron, not the fertilizer, but a different formulation, has been effective. I don't know if it works on this thistle. Check the label. UW-Madison has a great brochure online on sustainable lawn care, and it talks about more eco-friendly options, not all organic, but different ways to manage weeds in your lawn that can be helpful if you're trying to minimize the negative impact. Because you're right, anything we do in our lawn, on our driveways, in our landscape, has the potential to end up in the storm sewer in a heavy rainfall or in our groundwater. So I think being careful is very important and checking that out.
And and you're sure right about at least one, maybe two fertilizations during the summer for your grass. But also the other thing that our lawn care people mention is cutting the grass higher than most people like to do it. So 4 inches, 3 to 4 inches, 3.5, 4 inches is a height that really helps. Well, it helps the grass, for one thing, because you're not cutting it down so short. But when it's that tall, it'll feel good on your feet, Marion, as you walk in the grass. And it's also getting, it's shading out those plants that you don't want. Let's
exactly.
Put it that way.
And leave your clippings on the lawn,
yeah,
because those add organic matter nutrients. And a season of clippings is worth one fertilization. So think of it as you're mowing high properly, as Larry mentioned. You're fertilizing, adding organic matter just when you're mowing. So in my book, anything that gives me several benefits makes it a lot easier to do.
Yeah, absolutely. We have, let's see, oh my goodness, Terry in Cuba City emailed, just in case you want to open with a riddle challenge, the Garden Talk listeners, what did the Three Stooges have when their main guy took a month-long vacation at the end of April? They had no mo May.
Thanks for giving it up, because I wouldn't have gotten it, Larry.
Yeah, I wasn't going to make you try and
guess. Thank you.
Oh, man. We had Chris in Sturgeon Bay email to ask, how often should grass clumps be broken apart for best health of the grass? How can they prevent drop seed as well as other grasses from drying out every other year or every 2 to 3 years?
Oh, okay. I'm not sure I understand the question, so help me
out
here, Larry.
Thinking
and dividing?
I think we're talking about somebody who's got a native planting and not referring to the lawn.
Right. So if you're having problem, okay, thank you, and jump in anytime, Larry. So I find, at least for me, my prairie drop seed's pretty good, except I had crown vetch invade one of my gardens and it took over. So if you're finding, but I have pure sand where I garden right now. So if you're finding that, kind of monitor your plants. And a friend of mine, I haven't tried this with native plants, but a friend of mine, I guess I have. I've done it with Panicum. When the clump kind of dies in the center, especially after winter like we've had, what he would do is take a sharp spade or a Sawzall and cut through two directions, through not only the crown of the plant, but into the roots, and it stimulated and helped push them forward and reinvigorated them, so he didn't have to move them. And keep in mind, prairie drop seeds, a lot of our prairie grasses are warm season grasses, so they're slower to emerge. So you could buy a transplant at the garden center now, that's 6 or 8 inches tall, but it was started in a greenhouse, right? And the ones in the garden are just starting to wake up. This time of year with the weather we've had, I don't know about you, Larry, but I'm like every day going out, is it alive? Is it going to make it?
Yeah.
And I know better, but.
Yeah.
So I think if you, just kind of let the plants be your guide and where you're growing. And things that are blooming late in the season, the warm season grasses, typically planting in the spring, digging and dividing in the spring gives them time to get established. And so that's a good strategy, too. But don't be so anxious. I'm just starting to see my prairie drop seed. I'm in McGuanago, so I'm not, you know, Madison warms up a little sooner. And we've had frost this morning, 28 degrees. But it's slow to wake up. So give them a little time if necessary.
Let's see. We have an email from EAE. She wanted to comment about the fragrance of prairie drop seed. She says yes to some people. Their flowers smell like buttered popcorn. To others, they smell like corianders. But to some of us, they smell as a small dead animal must be close by. Oh, my goodness. She recommends that folks make sure they're not sensitive to the scent of prairie drop seed before they plant it near their deck or patio. Or anywhere else that they spend time in late summer. Here in Madison, it's planted at Obrick Garden, and you can check them out in late August and early September to see how you react to the odor or the aroma.
That is a great point about any fragrant plant. I love lilacs. I love hyacinths. I taught at MATC with a guy that hated them. And so, you know, that's a great point about any fragrant plant that you share your yard with or in your own. So thank you. That was a great point. I was in Chicago walking down Michigan Avenue, and I could smell the prairie drop seed, and I kind of followed my nose and found it. It was really cool. It was planted with threadleaf coreopsis and even sun-loving coleus. It was a beautiful thing. But I had to laugh. That's what made me think of burnt popcorn, I think, because I was in Chicago at the time.
Well, and she mentioned small dead animal, and I did discover a squirrel right after the baseball-sized hail that hit on our home. And I'm pretty sure that poor squirrel got nailed by my whole backyard was completely covered with these very large hail pieces.
Sorry to hear that. That's so discouraging.
It is indeed. And I think, time to remind everybody that if you have a question or comment, you can join in. And we're talking gardening with Melinda Myers. It's great to have her back with us. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Melinda, and you're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Coming up at the bottom of the hour today for our final segment, we'll be visiting with celebrated photographer and Chicagoan Jane Fulton Ault. Her latest book is called Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. Her husband was the gardener and native plant guy and passed away. And she'd never gardened, but she got into gardening to tend what he had started. And the photos in this book are amazing, just absolutely amazing. So we'll talk with her about the book and about her photographs. And there are some essays written by several folks in it as well that are really make an interesting read. So that's at the bottom of the hour today. Right now, Melinda Myers, our guest, and Kathy in Chippewa Falls has a comment or question. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry and Melinda. I have a question. Several years ago, one of my generous neighbors gifted me with what she called wild clematis or clematis. And I was so excited to have a new plant in my garden. It's been about 10 years and it's everywhere and I can't get rid of it.
Can you? Okay. So there is a native clematis native to Wisconsin, Clematis virginiana, and it's shade tolerant. There is also the sweet autumn clematis that isn't native that looks similar, and it's robust and vigorous, and I love the plant, but we're finding it is invasive in some parts of the country. So I'm wondering if she didn't truly give you the Clematis virginiana, which, you know, sometimes I had somebody once told me, if you see a bunch of plants for sale at a garage sale for a quarter apiece, you probably don't want them because it means they had way too many. And one of the things I've been lucky enough to work with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on managing invasive plants and trying to help all of us. And, you know, they're talking about don't share plants not only because of jumping worms, but also if it's overly aggressive or if it's invasive, you don't want to pass it along. So without knowing for sure if it was truly a native clematis, seen them a lot, even available, and usually in heavier woods, so there's usually a lot of shade and competition, and I haven't seen them taking over, and I'm wondering if it was maybe she called it wild because the sweet autumn clematis is so vigorous and crazy. So really, it sounds like you're going to be stuck digging and removing, maybe cutting back the flowers. One way to prevent reseeding but still help pollinators is when the flowers fade, cutting back so that you're preventing seeding, and that can reduce the seed spreading. Now, if it's a plant like purple coneflower, Rudbeckia, that the birds like the seeds, it's a toss-up, right? Do we let it reseed and then thin out the seedlings we don't want and enjoy the birds? Or do we remove the faded flowers and then we limit the food for the birds? So there's not an easy solution.
But there is a solution, as you described.
True.
Kathy?
So I would probably do some, you know, deadheading, so to speak, as they fade, and keep after it and dig up the ones you don't want.
Yeah. There you go, Kathy. Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Kristen in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I overwinter my geranium indoors, but this year I forgot to cut them back before I put them in the house. So now they're kind of leggy and they've got some blooms. I didn't know if I could still, if I should cut them again and put them out or what I should do.
You know, I would, if they're really long and leggy, there's two options. If you've still got growth at the bottom, you might want to cut them back to some healthy leaves or part way back. You could still try rooting the cuttings, you know, so you have more geraniums if you want. Pinching out the growing tip on long leggy plants, a soft pinch, does encourage branching. Now, if the branches are all kind of floppy, you know, you may want to cut it back a little harder, you know, halfway maybe. Usually we do our trimming in March, right? March, mid-March, late March.
Yep.
So you might delay the bloom. So that would be the downside. But you probably will have more bloom in a sturdier plant. So minimally pinch out the growing tip because that removes the hormone. So that'll encourage branching. And then maybe go back halfway and, you know, and that will encourage branching, but it may delay the bloom somewhat.
Kristen, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Jackie in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, so I've got a buckthorn tree in the backyard, which I like because of the privacy it gives me. But unfortunately, I've got 100 little buckthorn seedlings growing on the ground. How do I prevent them from doing that? And then what's the best way to get rid of them?
Well, getting rid of the buckthorn tree
is
really the only, I know, and I'm struggling with buckthorn and honeysuckle, so I get that it's a challenge. I understand, too, that the reason we have so much is you're not alone. They provide the privacy we're looking for. Consider maybe getting something, if you have room, something started. And, you know, so you've got it started growing. And then after flowering, maybe prune back the buckthorn. They're so tough and you know, they'll be fine. And at least that might reduce the seeds. Pulling the seedlings, that's going to be your best bet. There's some research out of Minnesota that talks about, this may not apply so much to you, but others that are dealing with buckthorn, plantings you can make after you remove the parent plant that you can then put in that helps slow down the seeding so that they compete with the seedling, so you have less of a problem. So you're experiencing the reason buckthorn is doing so well. It reseeds readily. They outcompete. They're a little lelopathic, meaning that they kind of prevent plants from going nearby, so they give themselves an advantage. So as much as I understand, if you can really think about in the long term the benefit of replacing it, you know, maybe with a service berry, aronia would be a nice substitution. Our native viburnums are great. Unfortunately, viburnum leaf beetle is an issue, so kind of think about whether, you know, I have some so far, not a problem, but, you know, that could change. So the long-term solution, I'm afraid, is getting rid of the plant that you like, and then you'll eliminate the seedlings and pull what's there.
There you go, Jackie, and thank
you.
Sorry, but thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You have a number of appearances on your schedule.
Yeah, it's spring, and it's wonderful. And I do have a lot of recordings. So I talked about this very topic on adding native landscape plants to your any size garden, and the recording is available on my website already in the handout with lots of links. And then I'll be at Ebert's Greenhouse Village this weekend answering questions. So when everyone's in line, I kind of walk the line and say, oh, do you have any questions? Can I help you? Which is a lot of fun. So I get to meet lots of gardeners. I'll be speaking at Roots and Branches on the 13th, talking about creating a pollinator paradise with a lot of emphasis on native plants. I'm also doing a fundraiser, herb container planting for the Pewaukee Area Arts Council. I always have to think about that. And that's on the 20th. And then right after Memorial Day weekend is the third of our library series webinar, and it's on managing your landscape with pollinators in mind. And so We Energy sponsors our library program. We do it with the public libraries of Wisconsin and the UP of Michigan, but anybody's welcome to join in, and I just appreciate the sponsorship. So, and then it continues into June, so it's been great. I get to meet with lots of gardeners, and like you, we love to meet with people that we've had a chance to meet with at some place along the way. And Enjoy Life seminar on the 10th, where I'm talking low-maintenance landscaping. So if you're looking for ways to reduce maintenance, I always am. I'll give you some tips.
And it's all available on your website.
You bet. So there's information on where the event, what the topic is, and how to register if you need to. Most of these are free. I think all of them are free, actually, so that you can hopefully learn something and help make gardening a bit more enjoyable this season.
And that's at melindamyers.com, if I'm not mistaken.
Got it.
Okay, I've got it. Let's go to Jennifer and pray to Sheen. Jennifer, what's on your mind?
I'd like to know how to get rid of mint.
Ooh, how to get rid of mint.
Oh, mint, oh.
We only have about 30 seconds here, by the way, Melinda.
Pull. If you don't want, you know, and using herbicides, you may be able to burn off the tops with an organic and keep after it. Digging, pulling. Any little piece, as you know, starts a new plant. Always grow mint in a pot on a deck or patio, far from any soil, because, boy, that stuff can just find its way to a garden. So, yeah, it's just going to be persistence.
Unfortunately, that's about all you've got going for you there, Jennifer. But thank you very much for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author and columnist with a whole lot of years of experience. And she's written over 20 gardening books. One of them in particular, a couple of them are my favorites of mine. You can find out more at melindamyers.com, of course. And she's going to be with us right up until the bottom of the hour today. So looking forward to talking with her some more. We'll take a quick look at the news in the meantime, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today, and great to have Melinda Myers back with us, our nationally known gardening expert. Go to her website at melindamyers.com and find out about all of... She's got so much great information in general, but she has many, many webinar recordings that you can view for free. And also learn about the books that she's written as well. So it's great to have her back with us. Dan in Eau Claire has a question for you, so let's go there. Dan, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Okay. The plate in my home, when we bought the house, it had about 75 feet of lilacs.
Yeah.
On one side, and they're really beautiful. They're about 10, 12 feet high, and they're dying out. I mean, I don't know if it's because they're so old or what, and I'm wondering how I would bring those back, because somebody told me that you can't dig up the little plants and move them because they kill them.
Yeah, there's a better system I think Melinda Myers can talk about.
Yeah, so a couple things you might want to do is, one, if they're getting full sun, lilacs can be very long-lived, and you may want to try to do some rejuvenation pruning to encourage new growth. If you feel that they're dying back from a disease, it's definitely worth reaching out to the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, because if it's got a disease and you take cuttings or do layering, you may end up bringing that disease with it. It could be old age. It just could be outgrowing the spot, lack of sunlight. But removing some of the older stems, leaving some of the younger, what we often call suckers, that aren't bad, but those are the new growth. You might have problems with a boring insect that's going after the older growth. And I find regular pruning on plants susceptible to bore with proper care also helps reduce the risk. And so that may be one thing to look for damage. Check out lilac bore, and you know, online educational resources are great, and then you have kind of a picture to go look when you look, and maybe pruning out the infected wood is a great way to stimulate new growth. My first thing I tried to propagate when I was in middle school was a lilac that my grandma had, and I took cuttings, and I stuck them in sand, and I realized I did it at the wrong time of the year. So, you know, nothing happened. They didn't form roots, but taking cuttings after, and it's usually right after new growth begins, so when the flowers are, you know, fading, and if you get some new growth, you might want to take 6 to 8 inch cuttings, pick up a rooting hormone, dip them in that, put them in a well-drained mix like vermiculite or sand. I like to put them in a bag, not closed tight, but just loose to keep the humidity up. And you could try rooting some of those to start new plants. The other thing you could do is layering. And sometimes this happens in nature, and you know, especially things that are low-branched. I see it a lot on forsythias. And sometimes what will happen, a branch lays on the ground, and it forms roots where the node, where the leaves would normally form, it'll form roots. And if you find those, any of those, you could try taking a cutting. But I would first try to figure out why they're declining. If it's old age, it's a possibility. But if it's a disease issue, then you may want to double check. I know last year, a lot of lilacs were dropping their leaves, and I talked to Brian Huddleston because I was getting so many questions, and he said they were experiencing septorial leaf spot because of all the rain we had in spring. So, you know, you may want to see, was that a fluke, or is this seems like they're declining over time? And again, you may want to maybe look for some of the newer varieties that tend to be more resistant to powdery mildew, maybe the size you want. But I would, for sure, if you think there's a disease problem, make sure you're not putting lilacs back in the same spot or any susceptible plant.
Yeah. And if it's just a question of age and, you know, there's no disease kinds of issues you can do, I like that renewal pruning. Cut it right down at the base, the tallest ones.
Yep. And then and you can do, sometimes lilacs you can do all the way, but I find it's less stressful on you and the plant. So the older stems back as close to the ground as you can. If you need to reduce the height of the others by a third, and you've got nothing to lose at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Dan, and thank you very much for calling. Yeah, do a third this year, a third next year, and a third the year after that. You just kind of keep revolving.
Exactly. And it's amazing. It seems like, oh, 3 years. But, boy, at the end of those 3 years, you'll be so glad. The plant will be beautiful, and you'll have saved it and bring it down to size and health, too.
Good luck, Dan. Thank you. Jody in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi, Jody.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am wondering, is there a native plant that flowers that is not invasive as far as suckers or dropping seeds that would go in a sunny location, drier, sandy soil, and about 2 to 3 feet high?
Yeah, you described my growing situation and some of my favorite plants, and especially if they're dry, what I'm finding. So I love Rattlesnake Master, which can grow 3 to 5 feet tall. I've not had it get 5 feet tall except when we had all that rain, one of the plants took off. So I usually find it more like 3 feet, Rattlesnake Master, especially in my sandy soil. You know, proper watering to get it established, but once established, pretty resistant. And it blooms like a good 2 to 3 months. It's very geometrical, round, small round flowers, leaves that look like a yucca. Wild quinine, that would be my first choice. It will take moist soil, but I've got it in sand in full sun, and it runs pretty dry, and it wanders, but not aggressively. I don't find it taking over my garden. I may find a few seedlings here and there, but not many. White flowers, it blooms for 3 months in the summer. And in the winter, the seed heads or dried flowers are kind of silver, and I think it's very pretty, and it looks great. And that's a nice kind of smaller growing size one as well, and that will take the full sun and do well, not spread. And you do want it 2 to 3 feet tall. Pale, well, that can get pretty tall. Lead plant, you have to be patient. It takes a couple years for it to take off, but it's got a tap root, so it's very drought tolerant, 2 to 3 feet tall. Silvery foliage, it's just beautiful. And spikes of purple flowers, it's gorgeous. So you might want to check that one out. Butterfly weed, it's not aggressive like the common milkweed. It is the milkweed with orange flowers that blooms summer, you know, kind of mid to late summer, couple feet tall. I find mine do great in my sandy soil. It's late to emerge, so the biggest problem I see is, whoops, I weeded it out. So when I have help, I always like go, there's butterfly weed, don't pull that. And what I'm trying new this year, and it's only 1 to 2 feet tall, is harebell. It's a campanula with bluish-purple flowers, lavender. And it takes sun and shade, or sun and dry soil, and it's 1 to 2 feet tall. If you go to my website, melindamyers.com, I do have plants that are listed by bloom time, but also it gives the height and the spread and kind of the good parts about it. And I find for me, when I ask a question, I always have to kind of do my research because what did they say? So kind of a good reference that will help you. And, of course, Neil's website, as we mentioned, is excellent. But this might help you narrow it down a little bit.
Good luck, Jody. Thank you so much. Dave in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
I just want to make a couple of comments. Virtually every kind of plant that has been mentioned, my wife has put into our garden.
Good for her. I hope you're happy with that.
we love native plants. We love what they attract. I kept trying to think of what else have we got. And you'll mention something, and I ask my wife. She says, "Yeah, we got that." So we got the Rattlesnake Master and the butterfly. We have common milkweed, and we do have pup plants. And false indigo, and just on and on and on. But the one plant that my wife is really going, this is crazy. We've got two plants that are growing all over the place. They just kind of run in everywhere. One's yarrow. And my wife really doesn't care about that. It's just like, okay, it's a feathery little plant. It fills in things, big deal. But The one that's driving her nuts is sweetgrass.
Oh.
Darn stuff is just growing like crazy. And it just, anywhere there's a spare bare patch, it kind of goes, I'm growing there. And it's just driving her nuts.
You know, you bring up a good point. So I first want to mention yarrow. You'll see yarrow listed in native plants, in perennial garden books, and as weeds. So I get it. Usually if it's with all your other good native plants, they help keep it in check. Sweetgrass, I have to laugh. The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's too aggressive. And then I read braiding sweetgrass, and so I have three plants. I'm like, looking for a place to keep it contained, right? It's like palm sedge. I love palm sedge, which will take sun, some shade, moist soil. And I have an area by our pole barn where we don't have gutters, but the water runs into a raised bed, and then it infiltrates down. And so it's been perfect for that because it can grow and spread, and it's contained. And I think you bring up a good point. You know, some of those aggressive things, you either need to manage them or put them where there's ways to keep them contained. So it sounds like you and your wife are doing a great job, though, of creating a wonderful, wonderful native habitat for insects and songbirds and you to enjoy.
Yeah, it sure does. Dave, thank you very much for calling. Sally in Madison. Hi, what's on your mind?
I've been dealing with pulling garlic mustard up, actually, at a couple of the dog parks in town. And I don't want to just, pull it and drop it.
Right. So good point.
Where, you know, what next? I don't, should I take it up to the drop-off site? I don't know. Please let
good
me know.
Question. And first of all, thank you, Sally, for doing that, for going out there and pulling it out. It's very important. And when it's in bloom, which it's in bloom now, you want to pull it, and you're right, you don't want to leave it, because what they found is it'll still form seeds after you've pulled it out of the ground. So putting it in a bag and throwing it in the garbage, you can call your local municipality and make sure it's allowed, but most municipalities let you throw invasive plants away in the garbage so it gets buried in the landfill, but check. You could solarize it, put it in a clear plastic bag, and sit it out in the sun and make sure it's good and dead. But you're right. You don't want to put it in the community compost because those plants, the seeds will form, and then you're putting them back in someone else's garden, and you've worked hard to get them out. So check with your municipality. Pull it. And I want to get a plug out for the Wisconsin DNR website. If you go Wisconsin DNR and then you do garlic mustard, it will take you and it will give you a picture, helpful ID clues, ways to control it with and without chemicals, and at different stages. And so I find it really a useful tool. But thank you for doing it. Pull it, bag it, and then check with your municipality. Most allow you to throw that in the garbage.
Perfect. Thank you, Sally, for calling in. Perry in Oconto, on to you now. Hi, Perry.
Hello, guys. Melinda, I have a snake plant,
okay. And
it probably needs to be repotted because it's in a very small container. It's about a foot high. But I have a problem where it seems to turn like yellowish, like an ugly yellowish color at the base, and I try not to water it only once every 2 weeks or so. So I can't figure out if it's root rot from being too wet, or maybe I'm not watering it enough. But it kind of just lays over some of the leaves, and I'll pull that leaf off, and then I'll be good for a while. But I'm kind of at a loss.
You know, you bring up some really good points. Snake plants do like to be somewhat pot-bound, but there is a point where the roots of filled the pot and they grow in a circle. And so when we water a plant that's pot bound, often the water runs right through because there's hardly any soil available to hold the moisture to let the roots pull up. So I always recommend, let's say you watered it on Monday, on Wednesday or Thursday, slide it out of the container and see what's going on in the roots. And that can give you a clue to over and under watering, right? So if they're slimy, then you'll trim off those bad, dead, slimy roots and then put it in a container no more than an inch bigger diameter of whatever's left of the root ball. And so that's a great way. So, you know, I think so much happens underground, and the nice part about houseplants is you can remove them from their container and take a look. It's a lot harder when they're growing in a garden. Snake plants, too, will tolerate low light, but they really prefer good, bright light. If you ever go to the Mitchell Park Domes in Milwaukee, I'm sure they have them in the conservatory at Olbrich as well. You'll see in Milwaukee, they're in the desert dome because that's really where they're native. They like good drainage. They like good, bright sunlight. And so it may be a matter of checking the roots, but then also making sure they're getting sufficient sunlight as well. So you're on the right track, trying to figure out what's going wrong and how to fix it.
There you go, Perry. Thank you so much for calling. Scott in Windsor, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, Melinda, I'm growing Mandevilla for the first time this year.
Excellent.
I'm pretty excited about it, but I'm already thinking about end-of-season care and how to overwinter, if possible, in our area.
Oh, you know what? Mandevillas are one of my favorite plants. They bloom all season. They're drought tolerant. And I'll tell you, it may – sometimes your first attempt isn't successful. But there are a couple ways you can overwinter it. Overwinter it in a good, bright, sunny window and treat it like your other house plants. And that usually works well. I usually like to prune back like late February, March. I have some in the window that I haven't pruned back, so they'll be going outside, hopefully some new growth, but I'll do some trimming. And they've bloomed for me a little bit, not abundantly, but a few blooms here and there, and you know that always makes me happy. The other thing I've done with success is I put it in a cool, dark place and let them go somewhat dormant for the winter, kind of where I keep my non-hardy bulbs, dahlias and things like that, my wine. And so it's cool and it's dark, and I water maybe once a month, cut it back in February, bring it up into a warm, sunny location. That's a little trickier, but if you don't have room in front of a sunny window or under artificial lights, LED grow lights are so much more affordable now. So just isolate the plant in the fall when you bring it in case it has any insects so that you're not going to infect your other house plants, and then you might want to try doing that. But I've had good success growing it both as a house plant and then also letting it go somewhat dormant, not dry out totally the roots, but in a cool place, and that's always key. If your basement is hot, it's going to be a little more challenging.
Good luck, Scott, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Emily in La Crosse emailed. She's starting native seeds indoors for the first time this year, mostly as an experiment. She's wondering if it would be helpful to keep them in pots until next summer and give them a chance to grow bigger and not get out-competed, or if she should get them in the soil right away to let them get established.
You know, I think if you can give them a little protection, so I mentioned I have a garden that the crown veg overtook, and so I'm cleaning up and trying to replace some of the plants that it took over. And I've got a lot of small seedlings that I purchased, and I have started some things using winter sowing. And if you can get them in the ground, they're pretty tough, but you might want to protect them if they're susceptible to deer or rabbit damage, or to mark them so you can find them. You could pot them up, and then you'll have to overwinter them, bury the pot in a vacant part of the garden, something like that. If you feel more comfortable, you know your space better. And so either one I think will work fine, but giving them a little protection initially, making sure you remember to water them if they're amongst established plants, because, you know, you'll need to do spot watering because they're going to need some help getting established. So I think figure out what works best for the way you like to maintain your plants or have time to do it.
And thanks for that question. Nancy in Appleton had a comment about supporting pollinators and birds and making sure the native plants you purchase are free of neonicotinoids. Wow. The class of pesticides usually makes plants toxic for their life cycle. And she's verified, been able to verify that companies like Prairie Nursery, Prairie Moon Nursery, Stone Silo Prairie Nursery in De Pere, the Door County Landscaping and Nursery, and Radke are specified as being neonicotinoid-free, and just points out. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great point. You bring up a great point, Nancy, and I think the people that are really conscious of that and aware of it usually either tag bee friendly, or it sounds like Nancy made some calls and asked the question directly, and I think that that's so smart and so wise, because we do want to be careful with our plants. They did find out that the neonicotinoids change chemistry and end up in the pollen, and that's taken back to the hives or the colony or whatever. And so initially, some of them were labeled for a lot of different uses, but finding out that the chemistry changed from the way they were monitoring, it was still harmful. So, Nancy, thank you for sharing it. That's such a great point. We don't want to do all this work to help the pollinators and inadvertently hurt them. So thank you for sharing that.
Another listener emailed to say, ask if there's any way to tell the type of clematis they have to find out whether to cut it back or not. It's the one she has is a very pretty one, pink and yellow trumpet-shaped flowers. And wonders, do all clematis bloom at the same time of the year? And not sure if there's doesn't bloom or if they're just not around when it does.
That's a great question. And I get very frustrated because it's like, is it a type? People have said, well, it's a type 1 or class 1 or class 2 or class 3. And it gets really confusing. Mm-hmm. And so your tag may say it blooms in the summer, even if you're not there to enjoy it. Very few of our clematis, very few of the early bloomers are hardy here in Wisconsin. It may be changing with the way it changes in climate, but very few are. And the other thing you could do is, you don't have to prune your clematis. We prune it to manage the size, or if it's had clematis wilt, to get rid of the infected part. So most of our clematis bloom in the summer or the fall, so we can prune them during the dormant season. Usually it will tell you. The bell-shaped flowers, I have a Betty Corning clematis that blooms for several months in the summer, and so I can cut that down anytime during the dormant season. I like to leave them stand for winter. I find birds in there and all the stems and kind of provide shelter. But usually for most of our clematis, doing it in fall, or I like to do late winter, and then before growth begins. In doubt, leave it up for a season, see when the flowers occur, and then that can help you judge when to do your pruning.
And Mike in Fall Creek emailed, he recently removed the majority of buckthorn from his property. The larger trees he could not pull the roots out of on the ground, so wonders the best way to treat the stumps. Probably should have been doing that right when he cuts it.
Right. I think it's within 15 or 20 minutes. So when they resprout, Mark Renz, R-E-N-Z, of the University of Wisconsin, has really good detailed information along with the Department of Natural Resources. So watch for the resprouting. I have an extractigator. I'm using all my smaller stuff, and it's pretty amazing to pull it out. But I have some big stuff, too, that I'm going to be cutting and treating. There's the hack and squirt method, where you just pack into the trunk in a couple places and put the pesticide in there when you do it. So I think you're going to have, Larry's right, you're going to have to wait for it to resprout and then treat those sprouts. But check out Mark Renz, R-E-N-Z, with the UW-Madison Weed Science Department.
And Mark's actually with us on May 27th.
Oh, well, excellent. And you can call back, too, and get in and see if he has any other good suggestions. That's great.
Melinda, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Look forward to another visit. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, Larry, and thanks to all your listeners.
Melinda Myers, go to melindamyers.com and take a look at her website, where she's got all of the information on her webinars and just a lot of great tips on it as well. It's great to have Melinda with us today. Coming up, we got a really wonderful book. It's titled Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're turning our attention to Jane Fulton Ault. It's a fabulous book. And she was never a gardener, but when her husband died, he left behind an extensive newly planted native garden, and then she became one, a gardener. And we're talking with her about how she feels it was the greatest gift he could have given her. Again, her name, Jane Fulton Ault. She's a celebrated photographer. Her latest book, which, by the way, was selected by Photo London as their book of the month, is titled Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. Has gardening helped you through a loss? Does photography help you see nature differently? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. Jane Fulton Ault joins us by phone. Jane, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
This book is visually stunning, I guess there's no other way to put it, and it's hard to get across on radio how visually stunning it is. But maybe to begin with, let's talk about the garden you photograph in the book and how that garden began.
Well, I think it began probably about 10 years ago. My husband started reading Doug Ptolemy's book, Bringing Nature Home. And I think he decided that our garden, our lawn was just, it was a dead zone. And he decided that he was going to start putting in a native garden unbeknownst to me. I mean, he just kind of went ahead. And I think he had figured that it would be easier to ask for forgiveness and permission. And he actually started on the public parkways around our house. We live in Evanston, Illinois, and we're on a corner lot, so we've got a lot of parkway around us. And I didn't really understand what he was doing, especially since the first plot that he worked on was, by the alley, and you couldn't see it from our house. But he had a vision. He had a vision. And the thing, we were having a wedding a year later, and he was having all of this organic mulch dumped on our lawn. And I was kind of horrified at what the condition of our garden was going to be at the time of the wedding, the home wedding. But over time, I started to understand what his vision was, which was really to not only change our garden, but also our neighbors. You know, I think he was hoping that up and down the block, more and more people would start to realize the importance and the urgency for planting natives.
And you really weren't involved in the actual garden development yourself, really, were you?
I wasn't. You know, in fact, I mean, basically, I could weed, but it was his project. It was his garden. And I even, there were times where I wanted to cut flowers to photograph them, and he was very uncertain about that. He didn't really want me to cut too many because he wanted to leave them for the bees and the birds.
And then he passed away.
He did. He passed away unexpectedly about a month after my youngest daughter got married at home, which was an incredible celebration in the garden. And, it was a shock. And my my kids had thought he spent a lot of time at the Lurie Garden in downtown Chicago because that was all native. And he used that garden to learn more about what to put into our garden. And the Lurie Garden, when they found out that he had passed away, the director had said to my daughter, tell your mother that we'll help her with her garden. And that was about the kindest thing anybody could have said to me, because I'm thinking, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen to this garden. It was kind of terrified about it, about the responsibility. But I did, you know, she came over with Roy Diblick from Wisconsin. He has the Northwind nurseries, or he used to, and they helped plant some things. And then he had an intern, and the intern helped me, really gave me permission to just garden, just learn from the plants, and that I didn't have to do it all, didn't have to do it all the time. You know, I could just do little sections. So it was really, I had wonderful mentors.
It sure sounds like it. And how did the book come to be?
Well, what I realized, this is my third book, and I'm a social worker by training, and then I started doing photography as my kids got older. I was taking classes, and we were traveling, and I took a class to learn more about my camera, and I had a particularly wonderful teacher, Dick Olderman, who taught me, you know, what it means just to ask the questions, you know, what does it mean to be alive, and what's dying all about, and I don't know. I that was a hook for me. And, I forgot where I was going to go with that. But, yeah.
And so you decided, is this kind of an homage to your former husband? Your husband who's passed away?
It is. It's my love letter, not only to him, but to life. Because, I've used the camera to help me to understand my life better. It was never about the photography. It was always about trying to understand my life better. And my other two books were about, all three books are about profound loss. And I've realized that shortly after Howard died, I called my publisher and I said, I think I have another book in me. And it's taken 6 years, mm-hmm. but the book has provided me a way to work with the deep grief that I had. I mean, it really, it's a process. The whole thing was a process, and it took so many people to pull this book together to be what it is today. I mean, there were many hands involved in it. And I think beauty is something that really soothes the soul, and certainly in the garden. I mean, I've just learned so much about what it means to be alive just by being a novice gardener. It's just really something to behold, to see these plants, you know, come into being and then retreat and, you know, die or you know, go into remission or whatever you mm-hmm. call it. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, the book is just, as I said at the start, the book is so visually stunning, and it really is hard to get it across on radio. Maybe you could describe the style of your photographs.
Well, the first section is actually, I took those pictures before my husband passed away. I had received some incredible peonies for Mother's Day from my children, and I was in such awe of them that I started to photograph them in the kitchen by the kitchen window against a black background. And those are the still lives that are at the beginning of the book. The second section, there's a they are very abstract images of the leaves of the tulips that were in the garden. And then the third section is actually the native garden that, you know, I've been working on. And, you know, I basically, you know, I'll be gardening, and then if I see something really, the light coming across the plant a certain way, and it's so beautiful, I just have to go and photograph it. And it's really interesting to me that none of the photographs in the book right now exist anymore. I mean, none of those images yeah. are there because everything is so transient and ephemeral in the garden, which is part of its beauty.
I was thinking about the photographs. Some of the photos look like traditional still life paintings, I think. How does that, maybe why that style, and how does it reflect the garden and what you wanted to say about it?
Well, it's more about, you know, first of all, I've loved the Dutch, you know, how the Dutch would do their still lives and Caravaggio, and that always attracted me. So that's part of why these still lives exist. But I feel like the title of the book is about my being still alive.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm still going full, you know, I'm full ahead. And part of that is the garden has helped me to heal. It's helped me to understand that I'm just a small part of a much bigger ecosystem. And I never had that understanding before. And I think it's through the garden that I can feel Howard's presence because I'm tending to these plants that he put in. And I also feel like there, you know, there's this love that just doesn't, it's timeless. And I feel it in the garden.
Actually, along with the photos, you have some essays. And we'll, I want to address those as it relates to the photos in the book. But first, a quick break. I'm Larry Mueller. And my guest today is Jane Fulton Ault. And she is the author of Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Talking with Jane Fulton Ault, author of Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. Maybe gardening has helped you through a loss. Maybe photography has. Give us a call with your own thoughts at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. I liked what you said earlier, Jane, about light. And as I mentioned, there are some essays in the back written by some folks. One, W.M. Hunt, who mentions, think of the title Still Life as Still Life to Live.
Yeah, it's true. It's totally that's what this book is about.
Yeah. The photos themselves are, you used a black background, so it almost appears like they're at night. But the darkness, as he points out, gives the work intention. It helps us see. I bet you like that comment.
I did. And I feel that seems to be how my work has been going over the years, and probably influenced by my mentor, Dick Olderman.
Yeah.
I suspect, yeah.
And I mentioned that some of the photos look like traditional still life paintings. Others, Georgia O'Keeffe is a Wisconsin native, or was a Wisconsin native. Oh. And some of the other photos kind of capture maybe the later work of Georgia O'Keeffe. Did you see that, or was that a deliberate thing?
No. I don't. When I'm photographing, I'm just kind of responding. It's very intuitive. There was nothing intentional other than seeing something that was incredibly beautiful and trying to capture it.
It's wonderful. And I like the way that you show and I like the way that and understand that you appreciate the variations of foliage as well. Did that surprise you when you started looking at the garden as a subject for photographs?
You know, not really, because it was around me, and I'm always taking photographs. I mean, I feel like that's my daily practice, is if, you know, I see something that pulls me in, I'll pull out my camera and take a picture. You know, when I was taking these photographs, at least the ones of the tulips, I had no intention of doing anything with them other than sharing them online. You know, I have this Instagram account, and I'm always trying to put you know, interesting things. Actually, it's more of a diary for me, but it's a diary in that it's been going on for 10 years, and I just try to find something beautiful to photograph every day.
Yeah. And by the way, we have one of your photos from the book on our show notes on today's program. So for those listening, if you go to talk@wpr.org/Larry, or just WPR.org/Larry, and go to today's date, you'll see an example of Jane's work, which is, as I said, really stunning. You sprinkle a few sentences here and there amongst the photographs. Did you select these words, or how'd you decide where to put them?
Well, I had help with the designer from MW Editions. I remember my sister-in-law, who helped me with the book, had told me at the beginning, early on, she said, you know, you really need to write an introduction for this book. And I thought, oh, no. You know, as a photographer, it's so hard to write. But over time, those words just kind of came up. And then, like, last year, I kept thinking I wanted to change the ending. And I just couldn't. I mean, I spent like 6 months thinking about it, trying to rewrite it, and because I'm sort of in a different place now. But I like the idea that the ending is kind of open-ended. Like, nobody really knows what happens after somebody passes. But I'll tell you something. I spend half my time in New Orleans, and I have these citrus trees that Howard planted, and they're lemon trees. And every morning I have lemon water from the lemon trees, and I feel like he's still supporting me, yeah. You know, so it's never really over.
Those three essays in the back, and one of them is by somebody that we've had on Garden Talk before, Doug Tallamy, a name that our listeners are pretty familiar with. Why these three people?
Well, Howard did the Native Garden because of Bringing Nature Home, Doug Tallamy's first book on Native Gardening. And anytime anybody walked by who was interested in what Howard was doing, he would hand them the book. And so my dream was to have, you know, Doug Tallamy write an essay for the book, which is a dream come true. It's kind of amazing that he was able to do it. And the book on transformation of grief with James Barrett's. After Howard passed away, someone had suggested that I take a course called Awakening Joy, and it was online, and I did it with James Barrett's, and he's Buddhist. And I did it for 6 months, and then it was during COVID, and then I decided to take it again 2 years later and learned that he was certifying people to be teachers. So now I'm teaching it. And kind of it just reinforces the practice of how do you incline your mind? You know, you incline it to enjoy, you know, to pick up, not to miss those moments of joy. And I think there is so much joy in the garden. I mean, it's such a meditative act to be, you know, with the plants and noticing them. And, you know, you love them and they love you back more.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And Doug wrote about the need to coexist with nature in his letter. And you know, we have scattered parks and preserves. Heat fields are too small or isolated and too few to sustain the species that support us. And then he makes the case for what Howard did by turning his lawn into a native prairie, I guess you could say, and it's and then makes the case we all could do better in that race, in that way. We could all work on our lawns and landscapes that we do have and turn them into places that help waterways. We were talking about that earlier in the show with our previous guest. We need to be more like Howard is what I think how he ended it.
Yeah. Well, I think more like just paying attention to our environment and what sustains us and what promotes, you know, the pollination and everything else. I mean, we need it. We all need it. And it doesn't matter if you're in an apartment building with a terrace. I mean, you can still put those native plants out on the terrace.
Yeah.
I think if we all did more, I mean, I think, you know, we're kind of at a critical time. And I think it behooves all of us to do whatever we can to plant natives and to get rid of the grass and to put in things that are going to, you know, sustain biodiversity.
Patricia in Milwaukee, we're starting to run out of time, but Patricia, have you got a comment for us?
Yes. First of all, condolences on Howard. And I know he's still with you because my cousin in Pawnee, Illinois, has her husband's garden, and I have my dad's garden in Milwaukee, and it brings great comfort. And Larry, just to let you know, I'm hoping to see you in the future because I am moving to Verona to be closer to my cousin.
Oh.
And happiness on your retirement.
Thank you, Patricia. So she has similar experiences to what you have when it comes to gardening.
Yeah, Patricia, I got the goosebumps when you were talking, so thank you so much.
Obviously, this is something that you would advise other people to maybe consider as they work their way through grief and maybe just the trials of the day.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think that the essay on grieving was so interesting to me because I learned it. There's a book that James mentions called The Wild Edge of Sorrow by Francis Weller. And he talks about how important it is for us to grieve in community. And I found that not only that the garden is kind of like a community because we're on the Northwestern University campus and people go by all the time. And I'm constantly pulling out plants and giving them to people because I have to thin. You know, and actually with these book signings that I've been doing, I've been giving out seeds from the garden that I collected last fall, which, you know, there's so many ways that we can support each other and build community. And I think that's a really important thing to do, you know, at this time in our lives.
Well, Jane, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and also for your book. It is visually stunning, and the essays in the back really help reinforce in many ways what you were trying to accomplish. So thank you so much for the book. I hope you sell a lot of them. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it, Larry.
Jane Fulton Ault is the author, and the title of the book is Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. It's great to have her with us. And, of course, great to have you listening in. This and all of our shows are a team effort. We've got Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and if you're in the Green Bay area, I hope to see you next Tuesday at the Widener Center. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.